This is a reading of a collection of essays and lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Education of the Child and Early Lectures on Education. This is the last or fifth lecture in the last part of the book. It's called Interests, Talent, and Education, given in Berlin, January 12, 1911. If we look at what runs as a kind of leitmotif through the previous winter lectures, and at the living essence of human beings, living not only between one birth and death, but in repeated earthly lives, then we must ask, what shapes a human being during one earthly life, and has particular significance in modern times? Modern people certainly question and try to understand the relationship between innate interests and talents and education. However, since people have little inclination to turn their gaze from what appears to be formative and direct it toward the creator of human beings, their questions easily take on an incomplete and vague character. If you assume that human nature contains something that gives life and exists throughout many lifetimes, you will recognize the complexity of questions concerning the essence of the human being. You will want to consider questions about innate interests, talent, and education in a new light, which is very different from simply considering what modern people so often emphasize, that is, heredity or characteristics inherited from ancestors. Spiritual science does not deny the existence of such inherited traits, nor does it ignore anything that can be learned from careful observation or through external senses and intellectual considerations. However, spiritual science recognizes how all of that relates to and serves the essence of the human being. This human essence absorbs it in the same way that matter in physical life supports the tiny seed of a living plant, as it determines its form out of itself. What makes it possible for that plant being to create its form externally is the substance, the matter it absorbs from its surroundings. Thus, in the general way a human being lives, we will need to recognize a connection between what comes into existence through birth and the essence of the individual human being from which a human being draws its spiritual and soul nutrition. If, for example, we realize that our tasks as teachers are connected to a human soul that steps into earthly existence and from hour to hour and week to week increasingly develops its inner capacities, and if we stand before a growing human being as before a sacred riddle to be solved, a being who has come to us from the endless distances of the cosmos so that we can give that being the possibility to unfold and develop, then many new tasks, outlooks, and possibilities will arise for all of human life. We thus see a human being entering existence through birth and assume that in a certain sense that being's essential nature is brought into earthly existence through birth. Conventional science shows us, if we ignore slogans and theories and look instead to the facts, how spirit and soul essence of the human being works on within the child after birth, and how what appears to us as physical structure is changed and fashioned under the influence of the spirit soul. Conventional science can also show us, for example, how we should initially view the tool for external activity, the brain. It shows us that the human brain is still undefined and very pliable when human beings first enter earthly existence through birth. It shows us how the child then endeavors to absorb the cultural treasures of its environment, and how that treasure shapes and creates the brain like an artist working with pliable material. As I have often mentioned in other connections, a newborn human being left helpless on a deserted island could not acquire the ability to speak. We must then say that the spirit and soul content of language comes to us after birth and does not arise from within the human being. It is not something connected only with a person's character or received without the influences of the environment, as with the second set of teeth. Speech acts on the human being. It is truly a sculptor that fashions the human brain. Through conventional science, we can follow the formation of the child's brain during the first period of life, and even over years. Even if we can offer anatomical or physiological proof that the human capacity to speak and to remember linguistic concepts is connected with one or another organ, and that we collect every word in something like a library book, we would still have to ask, what initially formed the brain that way? The answer is, the spirit and soul content of the language spoken in the person's environment. This shows us that when considering human soul development, we must differentiate people's thoughts, ideas, and perceptions, and also the feelings and tendencies of will that remain simple inner experiences, from what persists as such a strong inner experience, to the degree that it affects the external physical form and sculpts it as a future tool for intellectual capacities or soul spiritual life. We can best illustrate this when we follow human capacities over a lifetime. Follow the very different aspects, although psychology often mixes these differing aspects together. We can best illustrate this by looking at our memory. When we absorb something into our memory, when we memorize, we use something that has repetition as one of its primary characteristics. We have made what we memorized our own and can repeat it. Now everyone has had the unfortunate experience of forgetting. We forget things, and they disappear from memory so that we can no longer recall them later. Or don't you remember how much you had to memorize and recite in your youth? But does everything we have memorized disappear completely? We now want to look at what it means when people say they have forgotten something. That is, when they can no longer recall something well enough to repeat it. Has it vanished? It is there in a way similar to something I already mentioned, something we normally forget, that is, the wonderful, rich first experiences of childhood. We can remember back only to a certain point in childhood. However, before that moment, we had an endless number of impressions. Who would not acknowledge this when considering the first years of a child's development? Nevertheless, those things are forgotten in the sense that we normally speak of forgetting. But have they completely disappeared? Do they cease to play any role in the human soul? No, they play a significant role in the human soul. A great deal depends on our first childhood impressions, whether our experiences are joyful or sad, filled with love or indifference. Much of the total attitude of adult souls depends more than people usually suppose on those early experiences. What formed and developed our soul during those first years, but that we have forgotten, is more important than people will usually admit. The same is true of what we learn later. We forget the exact words and the exact thoughts, but they remain in our souls as a kind of mood. If, for example, someone at a particular age learns ballads or other poems about the tasks and qualities of great heroes, then that person might forget the thoughts and details and no longer be able to recite them. What one learned, though, remains in the composition of the character, perhaps as strength in the soul or as a way to face life, to bear joy and sorrow. The things we forget lead to moods, feelings, even to will impulses. They lead to what rests more or less consciously within our souls, but works and creates within us. Sometimes, through particular events later in life, we find that something we thought forgotten is actually not quite forgotten. We see that in certain circumstances, when there is an event related to something in their soul, that people remember something they thought was forgotten. In this way, we can show that we had simply covered over what we forgot with layers of subconscious soul, and that it still exists. In fact, we can see how what we forget, what has slipped from memory, works to form and develop our souls and reveals itself in our moods of joy and sorrow, in our courage, our bravery or cowardice, or often in our fear and anxiety. As things slip from memory and sink into the subconscious, they act creatively on our souls. We are essentially made up of what we have forgotten. Seen concretely, what are human beings, other than how they are joyful or courageous, and so forth? If we look at people as they manifest, not abstractly, then we must say that they are the harmonious interweaving and interplaying of their characteristics, so that they are the result of what seeps into the deeper layers of their consciousness. That is what we see during life. from everything we have discussed, and what we have yet to mention, we can see that what has sunk into deeper layers goes even deeper when people pass through the gates of death. Whenever human beings form their physical being during life with what they have received, they find a particular organic structure already present. Those structures have certain characteristics when the person enters life, and the creative forces in the soul must work against them. Suppose that we could develop courage through something we absorb. If, however, we have a cowardly constitution rather than a courageous one, then we must struggle somewhat against our own constitution. When we go through the period between death and rebirth, the essential activity of that period of human development is the preparation of the prototype or proto-form of our new physical body, that is, the preparation of our new physical earthly body. During that time, we do not have the boundaries and resistance that limit our constitution between birth and death. With what we have achieved during earthly life, we work there as sculptors on the whys and wherefores of a new physical body with much greater freedom than is possible between birth and death. Thus, the ideas we forget during life between birth and death work upon our souls, and when we pass through the gates of death, these forgotten ideas work on the fabric of our constitution until our rebirth. They work into everything connected with our new bodily configuration. Thus, through birth, we enter a new existence, with tendencies reaching much deeper levels of our being than the ideas forgotten during life between birth and death could reach. You can understand from this that since human beings base a new bodily constitution on their immediate surroundings, each person later uses again those conditions in a particular way. It is different with animals. As we have seen in the lectures Human and Animal Souls and Human and Animal Spirit, footnote Sigurd Hofsteiner's lectures Menschenseele und Tierseele, November 10, 1910, and Menschengeist und Tiergeist, November 17, 1910, in Antworten der Geisteswissenschaft auf die großen Fragen des Das Eins, Spiritual Scientific Answers to the Great Questions of Existence, G.A. 60, untranslated. End of footnote. Heredity determines their constitution. Animals have very specific willing tendencies because they do not take those tendencies from their environment. Recall how little an animal learns through training, and thus how little it needs a place in the physical world to express what has been received as formative principles. Human beings, however, need such a place, and for that reason enter the world awkwardly, but in such a way that they need only balance the finer details of their constitution. Human individuality springs from a person's own basic essence in the first years of existence. That is why the organ of the mind, the brain, is still pliable at birth, and only afterward receives its final and decisive paths, the lines and directions of how its tendencies should develop further. When we consider development to be a result of earlier stages of existence, we see it is less important than that we have specific educational standards than that we view each individual human being as a question, as a sacred riddle to be solved. We see that we have the responsibility to create the opportunities to solve that riddle in the best way possible. An education without firm rules, one that must appeal to artistically applied principles of teaching in order to develop the essential qualities of a human being, is bothersome. It is certainly more bothersome than if we rigidly say that we should develop one or another capacity. We have the proper attitude toward a growing human being, however, only when we consider each child as an individual, as special. If you want to take this in a trivial way, and today people have a gift for reducing everything to trivia, then you could say that individuality is visible not only in human beings, but also in every animal. That is certainly true, and no one speaking from a spiritual scientific perspective would deny it. I have often said that if you want to speak of individuality in that sense, then you must look more closely at things, and be aware that if you want trivia, then you could also talk about the biography and individuality of a feather pen. I once knew a man who could distinguish feather pens according to their maker, because in his day people cut their pens from goose feathers, and in this way had a personal relationship to the feather. Since he had a good imagination, he could easily think up a detailed biography for each feather pen. With people, however, we do not need to use that level of triviality. We must rather take our yardstick from the depths of cognition. Such observations show us how people sculpt and create their personality, appearance, and constitution, and how their essence exists within them. We can see from the way they live how human beings use what they receive from their surroundings, from what occurs during the first years of life, and how human development transforms and reforms them. It is particularly important during the first years of life that we nurture children's capacity to modify their physical constitution in a flexible way, that we do not repress their adaptability. We repress those capacities most if we prematurely stuff children with concepts and ideas that relate only to external perceptions with sharply delineated contours, or when we tie them to activities anchored in particular theoretical forms. In such cases, there is no variability, no modification, not even the possibility of developing spiritual and soul capacities so that the soul can act day by day, day to day, and hour to hour. Suppose that a father was particularly stubborn and decided that his son must be just like him. Throughout my life, I have made shoes for my customers in this way. My son must do exactly the same. The way I think is exactly the way my son must think. The son lives in a spiritual and soul environment that acts on his own spiritual and soul constitution in the same way that the father's was worked on, and the son is therefore forced into specific constitutional forms. However, we need to discover the individual living in the son so that his constitution can be formed accordingly. The human instinct for education has created a wonderful common means of enabling young children to work on changing, modifying, and mobilizing what lives in their spirit soul, thus providing free space for the formation of human nature. That means is play. That is also the way we can best occupy a child. We should not give children concepts with fixed boundaries, but rather ideas that allow the freedom to think about them, so that children can err here and there. That is the only way we can find the predestined path of thinking arising from each child's innate interest. Tell a fairy tale to excite the child's mental activity. Do not tell it so that fixed concepts develop, but so that the concepts remain flexible. A child will then work the way someone works who tries this and that, and by trying, tries to discover what is proper. A child works to discover how the spirit must move to best shape his or her particular constitution, according to inner predetermination. That is how play works. Play differs from activities with more fixed forms, because children can still, to a certain extent, do what they want when playing. From the start, play has no clearly defined contours in the children's thoughts, nor any clearly defined movement in their organs. Through play, children have a free but definable manner of acting upon the human soul constitution. Play and the accompanying soul activity of the young child arise from a deep consciousness of what truly constitutes the nature and essence of the human being. Those who would be a real teacher must be fully aware that they must study, recognize, and identify every capacity in each of their students. However, there are certain basic principles that show us how the human essence that goes from birth to birth uses what is external to it, that is, what is in the line of heredity. It is particularly interesting to look at the very different ways that the essence of a human being uses the characteristics, virtues, and so on from the mother and father, and from the ancestors of the mother and father, to create something new. The essence of each human being does not always use the parents' characteristics in the same way, but there is a basic determining principle which is very illuminating. If we attempt to completely comprehend it, to have full insight in that regard, then we must see that there are two viable aspects of the human soul. One is the intellect, including our capacity to imagine things pictorially, whether quickly or slowly, or more or less wisely. And the other aspect lies in the general direction of willing and feeling, that is, our interest in our surroundings. The entire way in which we can accomplish something depends on whether we have a quick or a slow mind, a mind that can more or less penetrate things, that is, whether we are reasonably astute. What we can do for others, and how we accomplish it, depends upon whether we know how to connect our interests properly with what happens around us. Many people have good intent, but little interest in their surroundings or in other people. In such cases, interest cannot bring forth capacities. We must therefore consider the question of interest just as much as the question of whether the intellect is flexible enough to allow us to do one thing or another for our fellow human beings. By interest we mean everything connected with how people express their desires, how they act, whether they develop gracefully or awkwardly. In other words, everything connected with the life of the soul and with our interaction with the outer world, with our strong or weak interests and our capacities. People inherit the most important characteristics of interest from the father, so that what arises from those interests, the capacity for what arises from those interests, the capacity to use our organs and our entire being, is inherited, in general, from the father. The soul takes the corresponding aspects from the father, so that we can develop those characteristics. In contrast, intellectual flexibility, including imaginative activity, pictorial thinking, and a capacity to discover, is brought into earthly existence through birth as an inheritance of the mother's characteristics. You will find this particularly interesting thought indicated in a certain way by Schopenhauer. Footnote: Arthur Schopenhauer, The World as Will and Idea, Chapter 43, quote, Inheritance of Traits, unquote, originally published in Berlin, 1894, end of footnote. He had an idea of it, but was not in a position to bring out the deeper aspects. On the other hand, we may also say something else. Living in the Father, as the way he relates to things, is his interests and desires, what he expects, wishes, or wants, whether he acts courageously or timidly, avoids life, whether he is pedantic or expansive. In short, those qualities connected with tendencies of will. A child receives all those characteristics, in a sense, from the Father. On the other hand, everything connected with flexibility of the soul or intellect comes from the mother. However, you can see an interesting difference only when you look at the entire spectrum of life, which you will find proven everywhere. There is a tremendous difference related to the child's sex. We can use Goethe's words to describe the wonderful relationship of the son to the mother and father. From father I have stature for the seriousness of life. End quote. That is, everything connected with the interaction of the human being with the outer world. Quote, from mother, a happy nature and a love for storytelling. Unquote. Footnote, Wolfgang Johannes Goethe, Sama Zenein, Gentle Satires, Volume 6, Number 32. End of footnote. That is, the entirety of mental life. If we now look at the daughter, we see a quite different situation. The father's characteristics appear in the daughter in a way that raises them a step above the nature of will impulses, raises them to something ensouled, so that they address more the interaction with the environment. Of course, we do not find it everywhere, but in the daughter we can find ensouled the characteristics of a father who always acts courageously, who takes an enthusiastic interest in all kinds of things, and in this way has great interaction with the surroundings, expressing a kind of earnestness. In such a case, the daughter has a serious soul life. The characteristics of the father are so transformed in the daughter's soul that they make the daughter flexible where the father might be stiffer. The important characteristics that the father expresses outwardly, we find more inwardly expressed in the daughter. The father's character thus lives in the soul of the daughter, and the mother's soul characteristics, the intellectual agility, as well as the talents and abilities that can be developed, live outwardly in the son. Goethe's mother was a woman who could tell stories, and in whom fantasy functioned in a wonderful way. That was carried a step deeper in the son, and became a tendency, a constitutional quality, so that Goethe, the son, could give humanity what lived in his mother. In this way we can see how the son carries the mother's characteristics a step deeper so that they become a part of his constitution, whereas the daughter raises the father's characteristics a step so that they are more inward, more ensouled. There is perhaps nothing more characteristic of this than the difference between Goethe and his sister Cornelia. She was just like her father, with an inner stillness of soul and a serious nature, which allowed her to be wonderful, extraordinarily good childhood friend Goethe needed. Remember that, and then recall, according to his own description, that Goethe never had a good relationship with his father. That was because his father expressed the fatherly characteristics externally. Goethe needed these qualities, but could not understand them the way his father presented them. They were appropriate for his father, but because they lived in his sister's soul, she could be Goethe's good friend. If you walk with me through history, you will see how at each step history confirms what I have said. We can find indications of historical confirmation everywhere. In this connection, we can find the most beautiful confirmation in the mother of the Maccabees, who sent her sons into death with heroic greatness because of what she and their forefathers believed. She expressed it thus, quote, "I gave you your physical bodies, but the one who created humanity and the world gave you what I could not give. He will take care that you preserve it, even if you lose your lives for the sake of your beliefs." End quote. Footnote 4, 2 Maccabees, chapter 7, verses 22 and 23, quote, "You appeared in my womb, I know not how. It was not I who gave you life and breath and set in order your bodily frames. It is the Creator of the universe who molds man at his birth and plans the origin of all things. Therefore he, in his mercy, will give you back life and breath again, since now you put his laws above all thought of self." Unquote, the New English Bible with the Apocrypha, Cambridge, 1971, end of footnote. We often find the motherly element presented in history, from Alexander's mother and the mother of the Gracchi. Footnote, Roman Tribunes, circa AD 125, end of footnote. Right up to our own time, we see how the mother's characteristics arise, giving a person the necessary strength, talents, and constitution to act in the world. We could look at the stories of significant individuals everywhere in history and find the mother's characteristics so transformed that they have moved deeper and become capacities. Let's take the example of Bürger's mother and his father, from whom he inherited his will characteristics. Footnote, Gottfried August Bürger, 1747 to 1794, German poet, revived interest in folk song and a force behind German romantic ballad literature. End of footnote. He had little in common with his father, who was happy when he did not have to bother with raising his small boy. His mother, however, had a wonderful, flexible mind and the proper grammar and style so necessary for the poet. Because Bürger was a member of the next generation, he took these characteristics from his mother and made them effective. We could also think of Hebbel, footnote, Christian Friedrich Hebbel, 1813 to 1863, German poet and dramatist of Hegelian historical and moral tragedies, end of footnote, and his relationship to his father. If you know Hebbel, you will find that all of his dry idiosyncrasies and peculiar interests resonate with what he inherited from his father. The old stonemason passed on much to his son, but it was the mother and son who understood one another, and the mother protected Hebbel from becoming a stonemason in his hometown, so that he could later give his dramas to humanity. It is very touching to read what Hebbel wrote in his diaries about the connection he had with his mother. We can find numerous such examples. However, we should not conclude that things are false if we find something here or there that contradicts them, which would be the same as saying, "Physicists prove the law of gravity, but I can discredit it with all kinds of special situations." Laws of that sort do not exist to account for every possible circumstance, but to focus on what is important. This is what we must do in both the natural sciences and spiritual science. But we have not developed spiritual science to the point where it can proceed in the same way as natural science. If you consider this, you will find the law of heredity I described confirmed everywhere. However, if you look at humanity as a whole, you will see that what we call the human soul and the human constitution are not simple. You could, of course, have an extreme desire for triviality and question how anthroposophists could have the audacity to separate the soul into three parts and human nature into even more parts. You could say that we speak of a sentient soul, a comprehension soul, and a consciousness soul, but it would be much easier to speak of the soul as a unity that thinks, feels, and wills. This is certainly simpler, even more comfortable, but it is trivial. At the same time, it is something that a systematic consideration of the human being cannot accept in truth. The separation of the human soul into its component aspects does not arise simply from a desire to divide and create words. The sentient soul is the part of the soul that first meets and receives perceptions from the environment. It is also the part of the soul where desires and instincts develop, and we should separate it from the part where, in a certain sense, we process what we have gained. The sentient soul is active when we confront the external world and perceive its colors and tones, but it is also active when things arise that most people do not have under control, that is, our urges, desires, and passions. When we withdraw into ourselves and process all the perceptions and so on that we have received in such a way that we transform into feeling what the external world has stimulated in us, we live in the second portion of the soul, in the comprehension soul. Finally, to the extent that we direct and guide our thoughts and do not allow ourselves to be led about on a leash, we live in the consciousness soul. In my books, An Outline of Occult Science and titled Theosophy, those two, you can read about the many different connections between these three aspects of the soul and the external world. These aspects do not exist just because we enjoy dividing things, but because what we call the sentient soul and consciousness soul each have a very different relationship to the cosmos. The consciousness soul isolates human beings and allows them to perceive themselves as inwardly self-contained. What we call the comprehension soul brings the human being into a relationship with the environment and the entire cosmos, and provides human beings with an understanding that they are essentially an extract or condensation of the entire cosmos. Because of the consciousness soul, human beings live within themselves, isolated. The human capacity that develops last, that is, logic and forming opinions, thoughts, and so on, is mainly experienced through the consciousness soul. The consciousness soul contains all of these. And with regard to these characteristics, the individual human essence that enters earthly existence through birth indeed tends most toward isolation. This innermost human essence develops last. Whereas the physical constitution develops first, a person's actual individuality develops last. Even though people were different in the past, however, and will also be different in the future, at present they develop opinions, concepts, and ideas in the most isolated portion of their being. These things influence a person's total personality least, and appear only after the personality stabilizes following its plastic development. Here we can see how human endowments develop along a specific path. We see first how the least isolated and least separated human aspect lives in the sentient soul, the soul of desires, which also has the greatest power to act on the whole human constitution. Because of this, when the sentient soul is working most intensively to form the child from within, we are least able to reach that child with opinions, theories, or ideas. We can best reach children by allowing the sentient soul to act. I presented this in my essay, quote, The Education of the Child in the Light of Anthroposophy, unquote. You need to pay attention, especially in earlier childhood, not to the development of theories and rules, but to making sure the child imitates and that you live what the child is to imitate. This is particularly important because the desire to imitate is one of the first capacities you can affect. Reprimands and rules are the least effective during that time. Children imitate what they see because they necessarily develop according to how they are connected with their surroundings. We can form the first foundation for the entire personal essence of a child if during the first 7 years of childhood we live what the child should imitate, after we have properly conceived of how we should act in the child's presence. For many people, This is, of course, a very strange principle of child-rearing. Most people would ask how a child should behave, but anthroposophy comes along and says that adults should learn how to behave in front of children, even in words, attitudes, and thoughts. Children are much more receptive in their souls than people commonly think, and certainly more receptive than adults. There are people, no doubt, who have a certain kind of sensitivity and immediately notice when someone comes into a room and ruins the previous good mood. Even though people today notice little of this, it is particularly strong in children. What you do in detail is less important than the kind of person you try to be and the thoughts and ideas you carry. It is not enough to hide things from children while allowing yourself thoughts not intended for them. We must have and live the thoughts that we feel could and should live in the child. This is uncomfortable, but nevertheless true. After the change of teeth begins, we can start to build upon authority. That is, not to build upon what people do, but upon what they harbor within the personality. During the first period of childhood, it is most important that children imitate what we speak, do, and think. During the second period, it is most important that children feel they have someone they can count on and whose actions they can recognize as good. When children are between the ages of 7 and 14 or 15, we should not reprimand them with the intent of developing a sense of a moral theory in them or of showing them that they should do one thing and not another. Rather, we can best help children if we can provide them with a feeling in the comprehension soul that what we do alongside them is good, and that what we do not do, the children also should not do. All of this is extremely important. Only when children reach the age of 14 or 15 can they develop the most isolated portion of their nature, that is, the consciousness soul. Children can then work with and develop their own opinions, concepts, and ideas. Children must first stand on firm ground, however, and our task is to create it. If we do not create such a firm basis by providing the opportunity through education for the child to freely develop as individuality requires, the child will then be overtaken by another element, that is, a stiffness of the higher bodies. We can see that in the way the child's eternal individuality fails to act on her or him, the child becomes instead a slave of the physical constitution that encumbers people from outside. We can see this in the way people fail to become the rulers of their spirit and soul, and instead become completely dependent on the structures of the body and soul. The character of such people is rigid and unchangeable. On the other hand, if we are careful to allow a child's innate interests to develop as far as possible, then that child retains a certain kind of mobility throughout life and retains the ability to adapt to new situations. By contrast, in the first instance, the child develops a rigidity of body and soul, which is maintained throughout life. We live in a time when people have little value for human individuality, which leaves us with little opportunity to realize that an older person can still be mobile and lively, can still find a way to new truths in new situations. Here we can see the way many people relate to life. Many people, once they have understood a particular worldview and become convinced of its truth, try to convince others of its validity. When they clearly understand something, they believe it is praiseworthy to bring this conviction to others. However, this is simply naive. Our opinions do not depend at all on what is proven logically to us, or that is rarely the case. People's opinions and convictions arise from a very different place in the soul, from the will and the feeling. People can thus very well understand your logical discussions and comprehend your clever conclusions. Afterward, however, they do not at all accept them, simply because what they believe or recognize as true does not arise from logic or intellect, but from the totality of their personality, that is, from those areas where will or feeling arise. Our thoughts are the last of our capacities to develop, long after our physical development is concluded. Thoughts are in the most isolated area, where people are least approachable. We can achieve more if we work with the deeper parts, with feeling and will, where we can still affect a person's constitution. However, when someone grows up in a very materialistic atmosphere, that is, where only matter has validity, then a number of feeling and will impulses develop that sculpt that young person's physical body, including the brain. Later, such a person can well understand good logical thinking, but it has no effect on the formation of the brain. Logical thoughts have the least effect on the human soul, and therefore it is particularly important that we find our way to other human beings through the soul, not just through logic. If someone's brain has developed in a particular way, then logic can no longer reform it, because once the brain has become physical, it always reflects old ideas. We cannot possibly hope that worldviews such as spiritual science, built on the purest kind of logic, will have any effect on people if we attempt to convince them. One who understands the spiritual scientific impulse and believes it is possible to convince someone else about it through discussion or logic is the victim of illusion and grave error. In our age, there are many people, due to the totality of their personality, the nature of their will and feeling, who cannot see the reality of the spiritual world and spiritual research. Out of the great number of people living around us, some are drawn toward spiritual science and have a vague feeling for it in the soul. Choice about one's worldview can occur only when it is comprehended through logic and human consciousness. A spiritual scientist knows how to approach people and differentiate between them. In one case, we find those we could preach to for years, but who would never understand our ideas. We would have to bring things into consciousness. You could speak to the soul of such people, but what was said could not, with all the resources available to the soul, be reflected logically. Other people, however, are formed so that they can comprehend what spiritual science develops and demonstrates logically, and thus find what already lives in the soul. This is how we must address the great cultural tasks of the present and future. We must recognize how a human being's whole personality relates to what it slowly absorbs of the truth, and to the things that must unite with the personality during development and education. We will value more highly the task of developing human spirit souls when we also recognize how the spirit soul is fundamentally the shaper, the sculptor, the artist of the body soul. Then we will place greater value upon pursuing the development of the spirit soul, particularly in the years when we can reach it through education, so that it can become powerful in its effect on the body soul and take control of it. We should be aware that people make many errors in this area. You can see from what I have presented how human preferences and so forth affect the formation of viewpoints much more than pure logic. Pure logic can speak only when desires and instincts are completely quiet. Until then, we need to be aware that when we believe we have developed a specific capacity, something we have left untouched will suddenly appear. Suppose we raise a child by emphasizing only the capacity for abstract thinking, as is so often done in school. Those pure concepts and abstract ideas cannot affect the child's feeling life. The feeling life remains undeveloped and unformed, and this shows itself later in all kinds of ordinary experiences. Even in highly regarded people, we often see two different natures. If they have been unable to develop what lies deeper within their personality, then things such as preferences, tendencies, and sympathies often appear in very different ways. Every student has experienced standing before professors who have a good understanding of their fields, and how a one-sidedness is expressed by a preference for answers stated exactly as they want to hear them. Woe to the students who do not understand how to clothe their answers in words the professor wants to hear. Moritz Benedict's book on psychology says much that is true about the mistakes made in education. He gives, for example, the case of two students standing for examinations before two professors. One student answered the questions as the other's professor would have wanted them answered. Had he given that professor his answers, he would have passed the examination with flying colors. For the other student, the situation was exactly the reverse, and thus they both failed. We can see from this how well we can clothe unassailable facts in logical forms. As teachers, however, if we cannot clothe our concepts within our teaching of the subject matter, we will be unable to find a suitable way to develop the child. The question is, how should we relate to another person? During the primary developmental years, we should approach children as little as possible with abstract concepts and ideas, which are ineffective, but rather with ideas that are as pictorial as possible. This is why I have emphasized that concepts should have a pictorial quality, that we should present concepts pictorially or in images. Concepts received as pictures or images or even fantasy have considerable strength to affect our physical constitution. You can see how a pictorial quality in things affects our constitution when you realize how little it helps to tell someone who is ill to do this or that, or not to do something else. This all helps very little. However, you can place an apparatus nearby that looks electrical, for example, and give the patient two handles to grip, even though you allow no electricity to pass, and the patient has only an image and feels no electricity, it will still help. Whenever you hear it claimed that the power of suggestion plays a large role, you should be aware that it is not just any power of suggestion, but one that is pictorial. In our age, it has slowly become the custom to give little attention to the spiritual scientific principle that children can only begin to develop concepts and ideas between the ages of 14 and 21, and that during that time we should give them concepts that will develop only later. We now consider instead that children are old enough before the end of that period to write newspaper articles or editorials, which are then printed and accepted by the public. It is difficult to keep abstract concepts distant until that time and to direct children's attention only toward what is pictorial. Pictorial concepts have the power to affect the body-soul constitution. You can find this confirmed everywhere, but people pay no attention to it. For instance, Moritz Benedict complains about how clumsy so many prep school students are later in life. This is because their education was so void of description. Education has very little interest in being descriptive and uses only abstract concepts, even when teaching languages. In contrast, even in our hands we can feel what is presented to us descriptively because we meet the object itself through those pictures. If you want to imagine an object, then you must move your hands in a circle or ellipse so that you can feel a connection to the pictured object through your hand. This is not just imitation, but feeling and learning to appreciate things shows us how pictorial images affect the limbs, making them flexible and limber. Many modern people, when they lose a button, are unable to sew on another one. That is a great disadvantage. We need to be able to act in the external world under all circumstances. Of course, we cannot learn everything. However, we can learn how things that exist in the spirit soul can slip out of the spiritual and into the bodily soul, and thus make our limbs limber. No one who was taught during youth to feel what is external will become clumsy later in life, because what lies below consciousness can best affect our constitution. The same is true of speech. A language is best learned when one cannot understand its grammar, because one then learns with that part of the soul that belongs to the deepest layers. Humankind and individuals have both developed in that way. On another occasion, I referred to Lawrence Mulner's remarks about St. Peter's in Rome. He said that spatial mechanics are wonderfully expressed in a concealed way in the dome of St. Peter's. He goes on to say that Galileo's soaring spirit later discovered the laws of mechanics that Michelangelo expressed in the dome, and that Galileo thus gave us the science of mechanics. I have also mentioned that the death of Michelangelo coincided with the birth of Galileo. Thus the abstract laws of mechanics existing in the human consciousness soul were discovered after what had lived in the lower aspects of Michelangelo's soul was constructed in space. In the same way that higher aspects of the soul develop from the lower aspects, as individuals we develop our limbs based on our constitution, and then we can look back and form concepts about them. People live in the midst of human society, submerged in an atmosphere that is the spirit soul of our surroundings. What they bring with them into earthly existence is thus formed and developed. However, people bring into earthly life not just what they receive through heredity from the mother and the father. They also bring an untold variety of a third kind, determined by the eternal human individuality. The human individuality needs inherited characteristics, but it must absorb and develop them. That is even more important than what we bring into existence as our individuality. We enter earthly existence through birth, and there a creative and productive spirituality takes over the formative material of heredity before we can develop concepts. Only later is the consciousness soul added. This is how we can see the human individuality that sculpts capacities and talents. If we are to be teachers, then our task is to consider the spiritual riddle that we must solve for each individual human being. All of this points to a particular attitude. When Goethe found Schiller's skull in a charnel house and saw how it was formed, how Schiller's individuality had worked on it, he realized that Schiller's fluid spirit must have acted to form his skull so that he could become what he became. Goethe expressed his thoughts with these words: "What more can human life achieve than the revelation of God's nature, how substance dissolves into spirit, and how that born of spirit is solidly held?" End quote. We need to understand Goethe's remark in the context in which he made it. Someone who would accept this remark without recognizing that what is born from the spirit is imprinted on a solid form would not understand it. You would also not understand it if you did not know of Goethe's deep insight into the eternal weaving of the individuality that moves from birth to death through reincarnation, which is the true architect of human beings. Through a simple comparison, we can see how we receive our organs from the spirit and how those organs are the spirit. A clock shows us the time, but we could not use it if time had not first formed the human spirit. We need our brain to think in the physical world, but we could not use it to think if cosmic spirit had not formed it. We would also not be able to form it individually if the spirit had not placed our individuality into our humanly formed brain. We can understand more deeply what I expressed today, and what Goethe meant when he indicated what determines all talents and capacities, if we understand the stars in the way we understand anything else in the world. We must understand what is active within human beings as something eternal that goes through the gates of death, only moving forward into new developmental stages. We can summarize what we have considered today through the mood of Goethe's thoughts in title Orphic Prophecies, quote, "As on the day to the world you were given, the sun arose to greet the planets. Then you began your unfolding in accord with the laws of your entry. So you must be, you cannot flee. Thus spoke the Sibyls, thus the prophets, and no time and no power can destroy the imprint that in life develops." That is the end of the last lecture of the collection entitled The Education of the Child and Early Lectures on Education, given by Rudolf Steiner.